listening to the Miles to Go podcast, the go-to source for travel tips, news, and reviews you can't afford to miss. Now, here's your host, travel expert Ed Pizza.
Hello, and welcome to episode 5 of the Miles to Go podcast. We've got a pretty full episode today. We'll have Andy Luton from Andy's Travel Blog on to talk about photo tips for your smartphone or your SLR. We've also got Jen back from Deals We Like to give you another It's a Big Deal segment. And I'm joined now by Gary Leff from View from the Wing. How are you doing, Gary?
Oh, I'm doing wonderfully. Doing better than United is carrying pets.
Yeah, it seems to be the common theme right now. We're going to talk award availability and some of your strategies on that in just a bit. But I wanted to touch on a couple of current events. Most recently, we had a self-driving car fatality in Arizona with an Uber driver. And there hadn't been a ton of discussion around this one yet, but I'm curious what your opinion is on it.
Well, obviously, it's a tragedy. So, you know, we should, you know, certainly acknowledge that. You know, it is one. It's not nearly the tragedy of everyone that's been killed in car accidents, drunk driving, and any number of other issues with the roads. But it's certainly a tragedy, and they're going to have to, you know, look at it, learn from it, and you feel sorry for the people involved.
Yeah, I wonder, you know, it's one of those things where I was having a discussion about this last night, and I think my overall concern right now is not necessarily whether we're going to get to self-driving cars as the norm, more that I wonder what the testing environments should look like and what they should be it's certainly going to be difficult to have some self-driving cars along with lots and lots of human operated cars at the same time on the roads and hope that bad things don't happen.
Well, bad things are going to happen. Bad things happened at the advent of people-driven cars. They continue to happen with people-driven cars. You know, if you're driving on the highway, you know, one of the most dangerous things is low speed limits that drive gaps in speeds that people drive. And so you have people driving inconsistently all the time. You know, I really do believe eventually we'll come to the place where, you know, we'll tell, you know, grandchildren about back when people used to drive cars by themselves. And they won't understand, because wouldn't people get into really bad accidents if people were the ones driving instead of computers? And you say, yes, they were. So along the way, there are going to be accidents. The key here is to learn and improve safety. And to not have a testing environment that prevents that kind of growth and learning, because we're going to get there. We just, you know, we want it to be as safe as possible, as quickly as possible.
Yeah, it still, and maybe I'm being a nervous Nelly. It feels like there still should be more testing happening in closed or monitored circumstances, more so than the open road testing that seems to be going on right now, given the total number of hours that have been logged actually testing the vehicles in adverse conditions.
I mean, I think the testing environment is a relatively sterile one overall across the different companies and the different places that it's going on. You know, we're talking about this now because one really bad thing happened, and so it's focal. But, you know, on the whole, most of the tests are going well. You know, and it's a developing industry and technology. It's, you know, I wish this didn't happen, but it's common to the advent of, you know, technology that has the potential to be dangerous, where, you know, there will be setbacks.
Yep, no doubt there will, and we'll hope that there aren't many as we move into the, you know, Jetsonian era of our future.
I mean, that makes me sound like kind of a jerk, right?
Maybe you are.
Say that, No, I mean, I know that I am, but the idea, I don't mean to suggest that the losses are acceptable.
No.
What I don't want to see happen is a reaction that leads us to overregulate what could become a much safer technology than people-driven cars, right? Because what we have is the potential here to have something a lot safer than we have today, where drunk drivers are on the road, where, you know, people are distracted by their cell phones and by texting, where you know, you just have people driving at different speeds or who miss a signal that a computer would be much less likely to miss. So we really have the potential to be safer than today. And so I just don't want to see that stymied. And it's not at all surprising that there would be that there would be a tragedy along the way as we get there.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Yeah. You know, you and I both blogged recently about some quiet Hyatt changes. And I'm still not sure if this is something that will come to fruition or if this really will be a test that that reveals information that Hyatt isn't wild about. But you reported that there are a few Hyatt Place properties testing out eliminating free breakfast for most of the guests in the hotel.
Right, and what they're doing – so Hyatt Place, as a, you know, brand standard, has promoted their breakfast. The breakfast's offering has changed over time, but they're testing not making either breakfast free or all of breakfast free. So there'd be a buy-up, say $10, whether it's to access hot items instead of just cold or whether it's to access the entire breakfast and, you know, see what customer reaction is, I guess, you know, see what bookings look like, see what, you know, whether average room rates fall as a result, and just see what the process is to monitor breakfast, because there's going to be monitoring costs versus just, you know, opening it up. And I always thought that, you know, hotels with free breakfast would be a great opportunity if I ever you know, didn't have access to good food, and say I walk in right into the lobby and just have breakfast, right? And they don't really, you know, they don't really look and see, sure. You know, you don't check, you know, check your room key. Although I guess I look like somebody that might be staying at the hotel, and it wouldn't be an option for everyone, but. You know, so what are the monitoring costs? And so I imagine that there are very real tests to see whether it's worth it, as well as what the effect is. Although I'm not sure how valid a test it is, because I don't think they make it super clear during the process, so that customers really know up front if they're just used to it on autopilot that Hyatt Place includes breakfast. You know, they may be more inclined to book the place because of that. You know, they may be surprised in some cases. And that's probably also part of the test. What's the customer reaction on the, you know, on property?
Yeah, I definitely think that there's not a lot of fanfare, or there's not a lot of disclosure in the couple of hotels that are testing this, at least from what appears in the booking engine. And I'm not sure if that's by design or not. As you say, it's one of those things where I do think a test like this, to get legitimate results that are helpful, would require some length of time, just because you have customer behavior so ingrained in the Hyatt Place brand. And also limited service hotels as a general category, that free breakfast is a thing. It's like, you know, like complimentary Wi-Fi has become. And I certainly, you know, when I first heard of this, I had a very stark reaction to it. As I've thought about it more, I'm certainly excited to hear – excited is probably not the right word. I'm glad to hear that hotel chains are looking at ways to innovate. The concern I have here is that I feel like Hyatt has already staked themselves out as, hey, we're the premium brand in each vertical. And so in many markets, they're already trying to charge a rate premium for that, as establishing themselves at the top of the food chain, if you will, in a specific vertical. You know, does this become the de facto limited service resort fee that helps them raise their prices in a way that's much less transparent to customers?
Yeah, I mean, the limited service sector, you know, many of them offer free breakfast. They don't all, of course, right? Marriott Courtyard doesn't. In fact, currently Marriott Courtyard doesn't give free breakfast to Marriott Platinum members.
Sure.
You know, Aloft doesn't give you the breakfast. And, you know, so there's certainly a space for that, and they may want to transition, and it may be, you know, it may be a cost savings. It may be, so it may not even be a profit driver if they can maintain their revenue. I think that Hyatt Place has tried to position itself as premium. Many of them are. I actually really like the room configuration of the, at least the new builds. Those old Demeris, I mean, those old Demeris Suites properties are rough, you know, and I just, and it's always amazed me that they haven't done more to require capital improvements in some of those. You know, the window air conditioning unit, for instance, is just the kind of thing that, you know, That properties, those properties need to refresh even just the, you know, beat up carpet and doors. So, you know, they're not super consistent. You need to know if it's a new build or one of those old acquired properties. I think that the breakfast itself at Hyatt Place, to my mind, has not improved. I happen to think it's gotten worse. I don't always take them up on it. More often than not, I don't, or I might have just a piece of toast. And it probably wouldn't change unless they actually, you know, at a $10 price point, maybe they gave you a better breakfast. I might be open to it. I mean, just it just isn't super appealing. It's kind of a low end buffet. So, you know, I'm not going to miss it. It's just, I think, feeds this narrative of you're really cutting that too. You know, it's less. It is less of a premium product. It is more nickel and diming. What is the differentiation? And I guess the differentiation is the divider in the room that separates the L-shaped couch from the bed. You know, maybe. And I guess, you know, we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how the test develops. Well, we're going to have you stick around a little bit to talk award availability and some tips on how to find the flights that you want for that dream vacation, and we'll be right back.
Today's episode is sponsored by Gogo InFlight Internet. With their new blazing fast 2KU service being installed on over 2,000 aircraft, you'll have faster than ever internet speed on board. We've got some great prize packs to give away from Gogo. Stay tuned to the end of the episode to learn how to win. Get Gogo. Travel happier.
Thanks for tuning back into the Miles to Go podcast. We've got Gary Leff here again with the View from the Wing blog, and we're talking about award availability today. It's a topic that I hear people talk about frequently. You definitely hear a wide cross-section of answers or opinions. One of the most popular ones I hear are that frequent flyer miles are a scam and that you can't really redeem them for the places that you want to go. It's just a way for the airlines to get you hooked. And, you know, Gary, you and I both know that there are tons of ways to redeem them, but I'm curious, you know, when somebody says to you, and I've never been able to use these miles for anything. They're worthless. You know, what's your answer?
Well, so first of all, I mean, it depends on what your expectation of in terms of using them, right? So, I mean, a couple of my favorite stories of people who actually claimed this to me. I had somebody once ask me for help looking for first class seats to Australia for the family for Christmas and New Year's. And, you know, look, Randy Peterson once taught me, you know, you don't say no. The correct answer is, what I can do for you is, okay, just basic tenet of customer service. And back when I was asked this, you used to be able to get just about as many business class seats as you wanted on Virgin Australia using Delta Miles. Once they started to roll out their new business class product, business class became a lot harder to get with them. But at the time, it was pretty darn widely available. And so I said, look, I can't get you, your whole family, first class to Australia for Christmas and New Year's. What I can do for you is, you know, I have four seats, Los Angeles, Sydney, same flights, business class, as well as Los Angeles, Brisbane. So, you know, if you'd like, it was a family of six. You know, if you want to split up three and three or four and two, and you can go business class on your preferred dates, Australia, Christmas, New Year's. And he says, you know, I knew these miles are worthless. Okay. I mean, so it comes down to what, you know, what is that expectation? I also had somebody who was asking for my help for New York, Israel trip. okay? And they said, look, what we want to do is we want to leave after – we want to maximize our time away. So we're going to leave after work on Friday, okay? And we're going to come back on the Sunday, you know, before going back to work. And so that's a non-negotiable. And we want to be really into the trip right away. We want to be like we're in Israel from the moment we, you know, step on the plane. So we will only fly El Al. And I said, you know what? There's a lot of things in this world I can do, causing El Al to fly on the Sabbath, not being one of those things. Okay, like your miles are just not going to be able to do that. And I'm like, well, again, what I can do for you is here's a great connecting itinerary on Lufthansa. Now, I expected to get the pushback. You think I'm going to fly a German airline? You know, no, it was just, you know, we're you know, our two requirements non-negotiable. We're going to have to rethink the trip. Okay. So I do get, you know, it's what are your expectations? In many programs, you can always spend more miles for the flight you want, the, you know, the standard or robust or style award. It's not what most people are looking for. It's not what I aim for in terms of saver awards. And it's certainly true that awards are more difficult to get at the saver level in many cases than they were, say, in 2010. You know, depths of the financial crisis, Great Recession, you had empty seats on every plane, and you could use your miles to redeem for just about anything you wanted. And things have become a lot harder as planes are much more full, and that presents a real challenge. But it's a common misconception that airlines don't want you to be able to use your miles because, in fact, you know, customers who use their miles are more profitable members of the program. One of the things that programs learned very early on, back at the outset of mileage programs, they used to give you 5,000 miles when you would spend all your miles because they were afraid of you getting off the treadmill. You're going to stay loyal till you top off your account to 25,000, redeem a, you know, domestic flight, and use all your miles. And what are you going to do? Maybe you'll move on to someone else, right? In the U.S., much more competitive market back then. The thought was that programs might get you to choose a flight that was a few hours later than what you wanted. You know, you wait around a few hours for your preferred airline to get your miles. But if you hit your 25,000 or the amount you needed for your award, you move on. And so they didn't want you going down to zero. What they found was that programs, when they let you redeem your miles, people didn't walk away from the program. They had validated their decision to earn miles in the first place. And so they actually increased the rate at which they earned miles. Customers become more active in a program after redemptions. It's become a universal truth. So programs want redemptions. The problem is, in an environment where planes are full, there's a direct trade-off in many cases between cash-paying customers and the mileage customers. And so in the past, what they've tried to do is make the awards available at saver level that aren't going to trade off, the seats that are otherwise going to be empty. And some of those are available when the schedule opens, but their information about which seats those are gets better and better as flight time approaches, and different airlines, you know, manage it slightly differently. But roughly speaking, you know, when they know for sure those seats going to be empty, a lot of airlines would just make those seats available close to departure.
Yeah, our problem there is that a lot of folks have already decided to book their vacation by then, and so, you know, the people are trying to plan their trips, you know, 6 months or a year out, and they may not find that availability and get frustrated. And, you know, I think it's a good time for us to just stop and acknowledge why I wanted you on for this segment. You know, your I don't even know what your lifetime total is, but you've run an award booking service for a number of years, bookyouraward.com, and you've booked gosh knows how many awards for people to every corner of the world. So you help people do this on an ongoing basis on top of giving people tips and tricks. You know, while we've got a few extra minutes here, I'd love for you to be able to share some tips with folks on how to get started and how to find that dream award for a trip that they've been thinking about for years.
Yeah, so, you know, I have been doing this for folks since 2009, for myself, for many, many years beyond that, and we've redeemed literally billions of miles. And as a general matter, what I like – now, 6 months out actually happens to be one of the better times overall and in general to be looking for seats. You know, 2-3 months out is harder, but, you know, 6 months is a pretty good sweet spot. I'd say that First of all, I'm a big fan of locking in a worst-case scenario itinerary and improving on it, even though depending on the program you're using, there may be some costs associated with making changes to your itinerary. A lot of those costs are lower in programs from Asia. I think people in the U.S. are becoming more comfortable with many foreign frequent flyer programs for two reasons. Number one is that as we've seen devaluations out of U.S. programs, many of the foreign programs are more lucrative. But number two, they partner with the major bank currencies. So American Express, Citibank, Chase points may transfer into these foreign programs. And you may have fewer miles necessary for an award. You may have lower change fees. But my point is, figure out what is a worst case itinerary you're willing to accept and then look to improve it. So, you know, awards do open up. You know, it's not like there are awards that start at the beginning of the schedule, and once they're gone, they're gone, and that's the end of it with most airlines. So, you know, you've got your trip. You might have a more, a connection you didn't want, or you might have a, be flying on a partner that wasn't your ideal in terms of their in-flight product, but you get to take the trip, and then as better availability opens up later, you'll make that change. Similarly, you may need to, buy a domestic flight from your home airport to the international gateway city. Oftentimes, the international partners have pretty good availability. You want, business class wherever you're going in the world, and the challenge is getting that domestic flight. So book the international flight for a while. Keep looking in case the domestic flight opens up. And in a worst case later, you may need to buy that domestic segment. But, so that's why I think of, say, poor domestic availability on American Airlines as being like a fuel surcharge, right? So they add fuel surcharges. It's very expensive to fly British Airways internationally. But say that you find a Cathay Pacific business class of awards to Asia, and you need to fly to the city that, whether it's Chicago, Los Angeles, that they're originating from, you're paying that ticket to that city. And, it's a few hundred bucks like you'd be paying a fuel surcharge, like many foreign programs add also. It's unfortunate, but that's sometimes what you have to do in a world of constrained availability. Either keep checking or be willing to spend a little bit more to get what you want. And you're still getting thousands and thousands of dollars of value that the mileage program is providing and saving real money compared to what you'd spend to get that kind of travel. It's just not nearly as easy, straightforward as it always once was.
No, I agree with that, and I think that's a big key that that I try to remind folks is that they are still saving just a ton of money over what they would otherwise pay in cash if they're smart about it. For somebody who's trying to figure this out on their own, if they don't want to use a service, any tips or tricks that you can give them, products that you recommend to folks that that might help them search for award availability?
So, I always, I write the blog to be able to help folks, find these things on their own. I'd always rather help someone figure it out for themselves. We're happy to do it for people who, don't want to spend that time. But I get a thrill out of helping people to figure it out on their own. I would say, first of all, for somebody who's completely new, right, this isn't the expert tip or trick. I just say, don't rely on the airline website because it may not be working perfectly. It may not include all of the partners. It may not be searching for the space. So just people think just because you enter in, I want to start in the city and end in the city, the website's going to give you your actual options. It's a logical thing to think, but it's often not the case. Not every partner may be on an airline website, or the airline website may be glitchy. Right now, British Airways is just not doing a good job showing American Airlines connecting award availability, for instance, because of some way changes in how American is showing the availability in its own systems. And it may not give every connection you might find. And so as a very basic, if you don't see what you want online, call. But don't assume that the first agent is going to give you the answer that you want. They may say nothing's available. Agents aren't exactly incentivized to be helpful. They don't get paid commission on the number of successful award bookings they make, right? So my rule with almost anything, whether it's looking for awards or looking for changes to your flight, if you actually don't know the right answer before you call when you're asking the question, I say call three times, right? If you get the answer no three times in a row, then then maybe it's actually a no. But just call back and ask the question more than once, because you may get an agent who goes out of their way to be more helpful to you. Now, if you're searching for things on your own, I mean, I think the first step is to know where the awards that you're looking for can be found online, if not on the website of the airline whose miles you're booking. You're always talking to the program whose miles you have, even when you're flying on one of their partner airlines. But you can often use the website of a partner to better find space. So American Airlines only has a few of their partners online. If I want to find award space on Japan Airlines, I will go to the British Airways website. If I want to find, award space. So basically, if I want to find award space on One World Airlines, the British Airways website is the most comprehensive, but it's kind of slow and clunky. So I'll often use the Qantas site if I'm not looking for Japan Airlines space, for instance, because they don't have every partner. They just have most. So go there. And the point is then I'm writing down or typing out what space I find, and then I'm calling up the airline and saying, I'm asking for that specific flight.
Right.
I try to be very polite in my conversations. Usually what I'll do is I'll ask about the major flight that I want. And then when they see that it's actually available, oftentimes agents will get excited. They're so used to telling people no. And then they'll also develop a certain trust that the things that I'm asking about are real instead of assuming no. What I always want to do is I want to find the most difficult segment first, the most important segment. Maybe it's Chicago, Hong Kong. And then I figure out how am I getting to Chicago? Is the domestic award availability there? If it's not, maybe I'm buying it later. And from, say, Hong Kong, then can I get to whatever city in Southeast Asia I'm trying to go to? Right. So it's starting with that most difficult and working backwards and forwards as needed, getting the information, doing the research yourself first. So if you have United miles, the United website is actually pretty good.
No, it is. It absolutely is, especially for partner flights.
Yeah. When the website doesn't error out, but it's pretty comprehensive. It hasn't always. It's relatively new that it again shows Singapore Airlines space. Whether or not it's shown Swiss or Brussels Airlines at any given time has been hit or miss. But it has most of the partners. Delta's better than it used to be, but their website too has problems. I prefer searching with the airfrance.us site for SkyTeam, although recognizing that Air France will give its own members better award availability than they give to partners. So if you see an Air France flight available on the Air France website, it doesn't mean you can use Delta miles for it, which is another thing to know, is that there are airlines that offer really good availability generally, and there are airlines that offer really good availability to their own members. If you have Lufthansa miles and more miles, you can book Lufthansa first class pretty darn easily. If you're using partner miles, you've got to wait until you're within 14 days of travel most of the time to be able to book it. Singapore Airlines offers their own members much better premium cabin availability than partners just can't book Singapore Airlines premium space between the U.S. and Asia, generally between Europe and Asia. It's only the short-haul flights they have access to. But the idea of not being able to find award space, there's great award availability if you want to fly ANA first class out of Washington Dulles, out of Houston. Cathay Pacific business class is often very available out of a variety of gateways, including New York and DC. I recently flew Cathay First out of Boston. Japan Airlines space they have an amazing first class, and it's really available out of New York, especially out of Chicago, within a couple weeks of travel. They just really open that space up tremendously. So you know, the seats are out there. A lot of the better seats are out there. Not every route, not every airline. If you want to go to Australia, Christmas and New Year's, it's going to be a challenge to do that in a premium cabin nonstop between the mainland U.S. and Australia, right? Connecting in Asia is easier, but you know, Christmas and New Year's through Asia isn't always a picnic in advance either.
Yeah.
So it's you know, when are you going? Huh. But I'm also like a big fan of shoulder season generally. Like I kind of want to – it's the old baseball line about the great Wee Willie Keeler. Hit them where they ain't.
Hit them where they ain't. Yeah, right. And no question, finding award seats to Australia is, especially in premium cabins, going to be one of the toughest things out there. You know, as we wrap up, I think you know takeaways for folks who are not sure what to do with those miles. You know, no is not always the right answer. Calling is definitely better than the website in almost every case. And when you're not seeing what you want, and even if you get no once, don't be afraid to call back and ask a second, or as Gary says, even a third time. Bookyouraward.com if you don't want to do the legwork yourself. But you know, as Gary said, you can make your own dream trip. It's just going to take a little bit of elbow grease. Gary, thanks again for being on the podcast with us. Hopefully we'll see you again soon.
Awesome. Thanks, Ed.
Thanks. Take care. And it's time for this week's It's a Big Deal segment. I've got Jen Steckloff back with deals we like, and she's got an interesting offer this week that involves a program that you might not think about very often if you're just getting into the miles and points game. She's going to give us an interesting strategy on how to use a new transfer promo to British Airways. Hey, Jen, how are you?
I'm doing well, thanks, Ed. How are you?
Doing good. I talk about the Marriott Hotel and Air packages because I think it's really the only way to think about points transfers out of the Marriott program. But I think what you wrote on your blog about using the Avios point transfer is an interesting way to look at things.
Absolutely. So it's funny. So Marriott has two different options if you want to transfer points to the partner airline programs. One is just direct transfer straight from Marriott, and the other one is through their hotel and air packages. And for some funny reason, the hotel and air packages is by far much better transfer option.
Yeah.
I'm not sure why that is, and I'm not sure why they even have these two different options. I mean, I get it, but the hotel and air package is definitely one of the best ways to transfer your points, Marriott points. Let's say you get a better redemption by transferring to the partner programs.
Yeah, I agree. I've always loved the fact that Starwood transfers at 1-to-1, even with the 25% bonus to such a long list of airlines. I generally don't recommend folks just transfer Marriott hotel points to an airline, but the hotel and air package can be a very good deal, especially if you have a great way to use the hotel certificate that comes with it. Tell folks about the current Avios promotion going on and how you would leverage that.
Absolutely. So right now, there's a promotion where if you transfer points from many different hotel programs, you'll get a 35% bonus if you transfer them straight into your British Airways Avios points. There's many different hotels participating, but one thing to note is that Starwood is not participating in this promotion. They did last year, and for whatever reason this year, they're not participating. So absolutely don't transfer thinking you're going to get that bonus. But Marriott is. And so using that hotel and air package that we just talked about is one of the great opportunities. So not only will you get the points and the hotel certificates, you'll also get that 35% bonus.
Yeah, just to put that into numbers for you guys for just a second, you know, you've got, there's a 7 nights and 100,000 miles or Avios package that you can redeem, again, depending on what category of hotel you're going to get. And so being able to pick up an extra 35% on 100,000 point bonus is huge. I think it's important to note, too, when you say Starwood's not participating, not that I recommend transferring Star points to Marriott Rewards because it's really hard to acquire Star points, in my opinion. But if this is your goal, you could transfer Star points to Marriott at the 1-to-3 transfer ratio that they have set up now, and then from there take advantage of this transfer bonus to British Airways.
Absolutely. So I ran some numbers, and I was thinking one of the popular ones is if you do the Category 1-5 certificate for 7 nights and 120,000 miles. That will cost you 270,000 Marriott points. So let's say we say Marriott points are worth about 0.07 cents per point. That's probably what most people will average them out to be. And let's say Avios are worth about 1.5 cents per point. So that could get you about $240,000 worth of Avios points, and really for only 1,900 Marriott points. So clearly you're getting a way better value in the Avios redemption. On top of that, you also get that 1 through 7 night certificate for the category 1 through 5 property. So depending on how you value your point, I always recommend having a redemption in mind. I would not just speculatively transfer unless you really, really, really know what you're doing and know how you typically redeem. I wouldn't. But if you do the math, you might find that this transfer bonus works out for you, especially on top of that certificate that you get.
Yeah, I think that makes I think you make a great point that you want to make sure you can use a certificate for full value. You want to make sure you've got 7 nights and that you've got the right category of hotel that you're going to use that. Obviously, if it's a category 1 through 5 certificate, you're going to get your most value if you can find a great category 5. And then on those Avios, I think, you know, if you guys were listening to last week's episode, Seth was talking about premium economy and using Avios for upgrades, both from coach to premium economy, and then what I think is the best value is from premium economy to business class. So these can be for not just for award tickets, but you can use these points to help upgrade you to a better cabin the next time you fly. Jen, thanks so much for catching up with us. I love the math on the Avios deal, and hopefully we'll talk to you again next week.
Absolutely. Yeah, thank you. And also, I just want to point out that there are many different hotel and air packages. So bringing you from a category 1 through 5 all the way through Ritz-Carlton redemptions. And then for various number of Avios points, depending on what you need. So if you go ahead, check out my blog, you'll be able to see those various package options. So hopefully that will be helpful.
Awesome. Okay, guys.
Thanks again, Ed.
We'll have that link in the show notes. We'll be right back with the rest of Miles to Go.
Thank you.
This episode of Miles to Go is brought to you in part by the Freddie Awards. Entering its 20th year and named the voice of the frequent flyer, the Freddie Awards have become the most prestigious member-generated awards program in the travel loyalty industry today. Every year, millions of travel loyalty members vote for their favorite airline, hotel, and credit card programs and promotions. Choosing from upwards of over 200 different programs, those who vote do so in over a dozen different languages from 237 different countries. No matter your status level, numbers of miles flown, or nights spent in a hotel annually, if you're a traveler, the Freddies want to hear from you. So run, don't walk to your closest computer, tablet, or smartphone, and visit www.freddieawards.com to place your vote today.
And we're back on the Miles to Go podcast. Today I've got Andy Luton with Andy's travel blog today. Andy's big focus is photography. And let me tell you, I've always enjoyed looking at his pictures. He had a post that I quoted on my blog a couple of months ago. It was his 10 best pictures from 2017. And I think it's fair to say that the worst of his 10 pictures in 2017 was better than anything else I took. And I think that's what I love about it most, because I do have a love of photography. And I try to take the best pictures I can with my smartphone when I'm out and about. But, you know, that only gets so good. And that's why I wanted to have Andy on. He's going to share some tips with us on how to take better pictures, whether it's with your smartphone or you're lucky enough to carry around some better gear. Hey, Andy, good to talk to you.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Good to talk to you as well.
So are you hanging out at home down in Texas, or are you out on the road today?
I'm in Dallas, Texas at my international blog headquarters, which is also my apartment here in Dallas.
Well, I am blessedly home for once, home for like a 10 or a 15 day stretch, which is record setting for me.
Geez, absolutely.
I know.
I was going to say it's been 2 months since I've been on the road, and I was just on a conversation just on the phone to my uncle. And he said, "So where are you going next?" I was like, "I don't know. I've been home for so long." He said, "Andy, you were in Norway 2 months ago today." I'm like, "Well, that's true, but I mean, it's the life that I live. Like, this is a long time. You know, consider this in context when I'm complaining about being at home for so long.
Yeah, 2 months is a long time. Sometimes I think I'd kill for that. So perspective for people, you know, I know you carry around some great gear, but you know, overall, I know it's possible to take great pictures from the road. It's something that I wouldn't say I necessarily struggle with, but my pictures never look as good as I think they could. So I'd love to sort of ramble through some tips and tricks that would help folks out there take better pictures.
Absolutely. Do you just want me to go ahead and jump into it? I have a couple of just key tips. Okay. So number one, I want to emphasize, let me give a little backstory. So when I travel, I usually have at the very least one. Most of the times I have two cameras with me. I have around 3 to 4 lenses with me. I have a tripod. Odds are I have a little flash with me if I need to brighten something up. I understand that most people do not have that. And let me also say this. There's a lot of times when I'm on the road and I have a $5,000 camera set up hanging from my neck and I see something cool, my instinct is to reach for my phone because I can usually take that quicker than I could with my camera. So I want to let everybody out there know that the most important camera is the one that you have with you. If you have a mobile phone with you, that's awesome. Let me put this into perspective. So in 1999, Nikon came out with a D1. It was the first digital SLR camera that had a 2.3 megapixel sensor on it. The price for that camera was right around $6,000 US. And there were lines out the door for people who wanted to buy it for 2.3 megapixels. Let's compare that to your typical iPhone camera now. The camera on the back of the iPhone is around 12 megapixels now.
Yeah,
so you have a camera and you have a camera in your pocket, whether it's an iPhone or an Android or like the Google Pixel has a great camera as well. You're talking about a camera that's four times more powerful than something that people would be fighting in the streets over 20 years ago. So I think the important thing we have to remember is that if you have a camera with you, that's the best camera ever to capture that moment in the universe that you're experiencing.
Yeah.
So it's always important to remember, like, it's a picture, whether it's a good or a bad picture, is better than not taking something because you don't think your camera is good enough.
No, I think it's a great point. And I think back to the days when I used to carry SLRs with 35 millimeter film in them. And certainly the world has changed quite a bit since then. And even when I look back on, you know, a couple of iPhone versions ago versus what I'm taking pictures of now, no question that the picture quality continues to improve. And, you know, what my opinion of a great picture is today has changed drastically.
Yeah. Me too, and I think when I first got into photography and cards on the table, I got into photography out of sheer laziness. when I started writing my travel blog at andystravelblog.com, I had these long, effervescent, effusive, well-worded posts that nobody would read because they were so long. And then somebody was like, well, a picture's worth 1,000 words. I was like, cool, I'll get into photography. I won't have to write as much. Makes sense to me. So I got into photography to suit a purpose more than having a love for the art form. Of course, it's slightly escalated since then. But for me, it's photography teaches you how to see the world better. Definition of what I call a good photograph is a photograph that tells a story, because that's really what we're after, right? If we're traveling, we want to communicate to the world what's happening, or communicate back home to friends and family what's happening. We want to show them a picture that tells a story, right? A picture of a leaf is cool, but a leaf in context of where you are in the world or what's in the background that you can't quite see, but you can make out that it's there, right? So if you have an in-focus leaf and in the background is the Eiffel Tower, like, that's great. You're showing them something unique and you're showing it to them on purpose. And so every picture you take is capturing a unique moment in the universe that will never happen again. And you're telling a story with it. It's just, it's fascinating to me, especially in the social media age we're in. that we all get to experience this stuff together, and you get to bring people along with you on your trips in a way you've never been able to before.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's absolutely about being able to capture that moment. For me, it's, you know, being able to show my kids 5 years from now where we were and have them be able to sort of trace the history of our travels through those pictures.
Oh, it's incredibly important. One of the things that I do since I've been getting into photography more, it's not just travel photos now. I was telling you before this that I'm signing a lease on a commercial studio in the next week or two. But there's also work that we can do to capture the memories of loved ones. There's an organization that I'm going to start working with very soon to take pictures of families before people in that family start chemo treatments. And because you want to be able to document the journey they're about to go on. So sometimes it's not telling the story that's in process. You almost want to capture everything before they go on a journey, or volunteering with a lot of photographers who volunteer with animal shelters to get great images of dogs that are, or dogs or cats or animals that are up for adoption, to try to save their lives and display them in their best light and tell their story the best they can in order to get people on board with adopting them. So the power of a photograph has never been bigger than it is today. With Instagram and Facebook and the social media era that we're in right now, a photograph has so much more weight than it used to have. And photographs are being used for more purposes than they've ever been used before. So it's not just, I mean, it can be as simple as documenting something for your kids. Here's where we were. Here's what we were doing. But it can be so much more than that now. And I think learning how to take great pictures that can suit any purpose is more necessary now than it's ever been before.
Yeah, I agree. Absolutely agree. All right, so let's cover a couple of tips that folks can use to take better pictures to remember stuff by. What's a good tip that you've got on your head there?
Yep. So number one, and this is a tip that I have to remind myself of every single time: slow down. Okay. When I say slow down, this is mainly in the context. Except when I'm walking in Paris and I'm sitting there and I see the Eiffel Tower and something makes me stop, I have to force my instinct is to take it out and take my camera out and just take a picture and then move on. But what I have to tell myself to do is slow down. What was it that caught my eye? Was it the Eiffel Tower? Yes. But what I tell people to do is finish that sentence. It's not just the Eiffel Tower. What caught my eye was, I love how this tree frames the Eiffel Tower and it fills this picture, right? So it's not just the Eiffel Tower in isolation. It's in context of the park that I'm sitting in next to this bench with the contrast against the black of the Eiffel Tower and the blue sky.
And yeah, so then that's a great point.
I just tell people to slow down. And then when you answer that question, like what made me stop, what you've just done is you've told yourself what to include in the picture, right? So if it's the bench with the flowers next to it, and there's the tree that frames the top of the Eiffel Tower, well, all I have to do is get what's in my phone or get what's in my lens to look like what I just described. And that's the story that I want to tell. So there's times where you need to slow down, and then there's times where you just have to speed up and get the picture because it's a fleeting moment that may never happen again.
Yeah.
And that's fine, right? So whenever it's a fleeting moment, you take whatever picture you can take. If it's grainy, if it's out of focus, I'll tell you what, a grainy or out of focus picture of something occurring is better than not having a picture of it at all. But when the situation allows, the best tip I have for people is slow down and ask yourself, what caught your eye?
Cool. Okay. So slow down. I think that's a great thing to get people to think and focus on why they loved what it was they want to capture. What's another great tip that we can share with folks?
If you're taking pictures of people, pay attention to the background. A very bad habit that I personally get into, and I've had to go and delete pictures because of it, is I'm great at taking pictures of people who have trees growing out of their heads. And it's just the greatest picture in the world, and their expression's great. It looks pretty epic, and it'll be in the middle of a field, but then there is one tree in that field, and that tree happens to be exactly behind the subject of the picture. And of course, it's growing right out of their head, and I can't use that picture. So always pay attention to the background. Pay attention to the place and the story that you're trying to tell. So if you're trying to, and I'm just going to use the Eiffel Tower again because it's very poignant. Everybody knows what we're referring to, or the Sydney Opera House, or, you know, whatever. If it's a picture of people in front of the Eiffel Tower, is it better to have them in front of the Eiffel Tower, or is it better to have them next to the Eiffel Tower, where it's, you know, them looking at the Eiffel Tower? Like, what tells the story there? So it's paying attention to what's in your background and then using that to tell the story. It's very important to make sure you're not blocking anything important, and make sure you're not having any distracting elements in the background of the picture as well. So what you'll typically see most often are light poles, traffic signs, and there are some hilarious ones. I took a picture of somebody in stop sign right above their head, and it said stop, and then my subject's face.
Yeah, so that kind of spoils your end goal.
Right, yeah. It's hard to tell a story like, oh, what did you want them to stop? It's like, well, nothing, but we're in Italy. And they're like, well, it looks like you're at a stop sign. Dang it. Okay, you're right.
That's great. All right, well, we've got time for one more tip. What's one more tip that we can share with folks on how to take better pictures when they're traveling?
One more tip. Always make sure you can see what the subject of the picture is. And that sounds very ethereal, but what I would ask the listeners to do is take out your phone or look at some of the last five pictures you've taken and ask yourself, what was this picture of? And make sure your pictures are about something, and make sure that it's obvious what they're about. Right. So a buddy of mine sent me a picture, and I have a lot of friends who do this. They're like, hey, man, what do you think of this one? And they always say, like, just if I can step aside for a second, they always say, like, man, I know this one isn't as good as any of yours. I'm like, listen, guys, last year I took 41,000 pictures.
41,000?
I'm not making that up.
41,000?
I took 41,000 pictures last year. Of that 41,000, I published or processed maybe 1,000.
Wow. Wow. That's over 100 pictures a day.
Yeah. So I guarantee that I took far more worse pictures, both number and quality, than almost anybody out there. So I always tell people, like, have some confidence. Like, don't worry about the pictures that I'm taking. Worry about, like, I'm excited to see pictures that friends are taking. I'm excited to see them interested in it, and I'm excited to see them want to get better. So, I mean, that's why I share a lot of photography tips and like Lightroom editing videos on my YouTube channel and on the blog. But a buddy of mine sent me a picture of a park he was at in Barcelona. And he said, hey, man, what do you think? And I said, I mean, it's a pretty picture, right? Things are in focus. Things are sharp. But what's this a picture of? Because it just looks like it's a picture of a park, right? What's the story? What is this about? What are you trying to show me, right? If you look at the etymology of the word photograph, you're simply drawing with light. Okay, so very few people, if you're an artist, if you're a painter, you're not going to draw a picture of nothing. Right. You're drawing a picture of something. So what are you using your camera to capture? What is this picture about? And always try to answer that. It's very similar to that first thing. Slow down, but then make your picture about something. And what is that going to be about? What is the subject of that picture? And as you're going through a trip, make sure that you're looking back and, like, the pictures that you choose to share on Facebook, on Instagram, wherever it is, make sure you ask yourself that before you publish a picture of something and before you share that with your friends and your family, because it should be obvious. Unless you get into the truly, like, avant-garde fine art photography, for social media photography, as I call it, you should always be able to immediately recognize, what is this a picture of? What are they doing? And maybe even some of the why.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Yep, no question. Especially, like you say, with the immediacy of social media. Before we run out of time here, I'd love to have you back on to talk more details about the gear that you carry. In the meantime, you mentioned YouTube. Can you tell people where they can find you, your website, your YouTube channels, so they can track down some of these great pictures?
Yeah, absolutely. So the blog is andystravelblog.com. The Instagram handle, I'm currently trying to buy at Andy's Travel Blog from the person who has it. So my Instagram handle is at Real Andy Luton. So everybody knows it's not any fakers. And then the YouTube channel is simply Andy's Travel Blog. Okay. So it's I'm bad at coming up with creative blog titles. So that's kind of it. And what's funny is, so this is my favorite, like, creative, uncreative moment. So the blog's name is Andy's Travel Blog, and then my tagline is imagine a more creative title, just, you know, so they can come up with their own.
Yeah.
I get hundreds of visits a month from people who are searching Google for creative blog titles. some reason that tagline brings into my blogs. I'm like, cool, I'll take it. Hopefully they enjoy the pictures while they're here instead of seeing an example of what they're trying to avoid.
Oh, that's awesome. That's a great punchline. All right, Andy, well, thanks so much for being on and sharing some tips with us. We'll talk to you again soon.
Awesome. My pleasure.
It's time to wrap up this episode with the final two pennies. When we started off the episode, we were talking about a self-driving car fatality, an Uber car that hit and killed a woman in Arizona recently. Since we've been putting all the audio together, there's an update on the story, and it sounds like the accident was not preventable. The police chief in the area has come out to say that they believe that even a human behind the wheel wouldn't have been able to avoid the accident. There was a human behind the wheel in the situation. It's unclear whether the human tried to grab the steering wheel or not. Still a lot of details coming out here. It feels like self-driving car technology is moving fast, maybe faster than I anticipated. I'll be interested to see how this story develops. One more quick point. There was a flight deal earlier this week, fares that were less than $100 one way to Hawaii. So a $200 round trip, or in this case, $177 round trip ticket to Hawaii, which is a fare I just don't remember seeing. And certainly this wasn't available from every city, but it was available from a half a dozen places. And I think it's just a good reminder that when you see things like this pop up, don't start thinking about when and where and how and do you have the time off. The right decision, if you're leaning towards it, is just to book one real quick. And always remember, if it's a flight that originates or departs the United States or returns to the United States, you've got 24 hours to cancel that reservation. You want to make sure you do that if you're not going to travel. But the point here is that if you wait and think about it, maybe call some friends, these tickets disappear really quickly. This was a flash sale, not a mistake sale, but we're not going to see $100 one-way fares to Hawaii very often, and when they do pop up, they're going to go quickly. That's a wrap on episode 5. I hope you're enjoying the podcast. You can find links to all the discussion topics and our guests on our website at milestogo.boardingarea.com. If you're enjoying listening to the podcast, I hope you'll help me make it grow. Best way you can do that is to take a moment to rate the podcast, whether you're listening on iTunes or Google Play or one of the other podcasting platforms where you can find us. The higher the rating for the podcast, the more people will see it pop up in the search results. You also still have time to enter our first giveaway. GoGo InFlight Internet has given me some awesome prize packs that we'll be giving away to listeners. It's really easy to enter. Go to www.milestogo.boardingarea.com/GoGo. You'll need to enter this week's secret phrase. GoGo's been rolling out a new service that's much faster than previous versions. Today's secret phrase is InFlight. I guess that's a secret word, not a secret phrase. For speedy in-flight internet, that's in-flight. Thanks for listening. See you next time. We've got miles to go.